We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Hey, yo, and here we go. It is We Talk Comics episode 136. It's the call-in special. Nice. I'm your host Keith, and I am joined by Chris. Say hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Oh God, I used Brett's joke.
That's good. Recycling. It's good for the planet. And we have a caller on the line. Long time listener, first time caller. Introduce yourself.
Hey, yo. It's Reese. That's about all I got.
Reese Marino. Now, Reese, we have talked about having you on the show many times. This time we actually decided to do it.
Yeah. And thank you very much.
Now you've done a bit of comic work, and as well as being you're a big comic fan, we're going to just chat about some comics. What's the little bit of comic stuff you've done?
Probably the thing that anybody would know me from would be the Amelia Cole books, published by Monkey Brain, written by Adam P. Nave, DJ Kirkbride, illustrated by Nick Brokenshire, lettered by Rachel Deering. Also print published by IDW. So that would be, I've done color assisting on that book. That's probably what everybody's going to know me from, if you know me at all. And then I've had several pinups I've done for the Comics Tribe people. I've done a couple things for them. And then just, you know, your general pitch work, stuff that nobody ever sees, but you kind of just get to go, maybe, maybe, maybe. But that's about it.
And what is color assist? What were you doing on the book? Explain a bit about the color process.
Okay, this is where it gets interesting, because sometimes people are real picky about their terminology. You've got a flatter, you've got a color assistant, and then of course you got your colorist. A flatter, as most people know, just basically gets the page from either the inker or the artist directly, and just basically lays down a bunch of different colors to separate the objects on the page. A color assist takes that page from the artist or the inker and basically lays out the base tone colors on the page. Not any of the highlights or the shadows or any of the effects added towards that. So basically you get what the base tone is of the pages, and then the colorist can just quickly go in and maybe spend 20 minutes on a page to add shadows and highlights and anything else. So basically the color assistant gets stuck doing the long, boring part that we imagine being fun. if that makes sense. So it's not bad by any means. I enjoyed it. The only reason that I didn't take on the full colorist position was because I just didn't have the time for it, to be honest with you. I've got a family to take care of, and I love comic books to death. I love coloring comic books, but it's just my other job kind of just takes most of my time. So I have to be a part of it somehow, and that worked out for me.
So how much time goes into coloring a page? I know it could vary massively, but...
Right. Well, you know, if you're looking at your normal, maybe, 6 Yeah, and typically most pages are like 6 to 8 grid layouts. Anything like that can range anywhere from, depending on the detail, if you get someone who does like a lot of background work, as like Nick Brokenshire on Amelia Cole, he does a lot of background work. Those pages, just even color assisting those pages, could take up to 4 hours. And that's your base tone colors. So adding in details and shadows and highlights on top of that, I'd probably say it could take up to about 6 hours just to do one page, depending on how detailed it is. If you get something where it's, I'm not going to name any names, but there are artists, you know, that you don't really see a whole lot of backgrounds for. Something like that could probably take about 3 hours tops. So, and that's if you're like, hey, let me experiment with this panel over here. Or, let me change that color over there. And that's roughly about the time frame you're looking at. So I think the longest a page has ever actually taken me is roughly around, like, total time spent on one page has been about 8 hours. And that was a page where I was dealing with basically a lot of real small detail that nobody else is going to notice.
They'll only notice if it's all one big splash of color.
Exactly.
Like the old Kirby ones were.
Right. Really? Well, you know, like if you flip through like some of the Amelia Cole pages, there's a running theme. There is a lot of rubble in that series. A lot of destruction. I mean, a lot. And I don't, you know, you never really notice it the way it's illustrated and colored, because that's the way it's supposed to be. It's rubble, you know. You're not going to notice a pile of dirt looks any different than a pile of dirt. So, but sometimes you have to color rubble different. And like, okay, so you'll get like this thing that's, you know, not even the size of like a, I'm trying to think of a good, I don't know, maybe like a, hell, it's smaller than a penny, smaller than a penny. And let's say there's a side of it showing that, you know, in like, if you're, in my mind, I'm the colorist, I'm looking at this, or even the color assist, I'm like, I know the side of that's got to be a different color, but damn it, that thing is so small. Is anybody really going to notice?
I think it's part important that we don't discount rubble. I followed George Perez for about 10 years just for the rubble.
Yeah. You know,
he drew awesome rubble, and usually it was colored correctly, and that's all I cared about, is how much rubble is in this issue.
I thanked him for that when I met him, actually. I met him at a show, and he was doing a sketch for me, and I said, thank you for the rubble. And he was kind of confused, and I said, all the smashed buildings. You do destruction and smashed buildings better than anybody. He really appreciated that.
Yeah, you should thank that colorist. That would be the run-in whenever I'd get a script in from Adam. And I'd look at it, read it, and I'd go, oh, hell, there's rubble. It was the writing bag where we didn't joke about it. As a matter of fact, for one of my birthdays, the artist Nick, he actually sent me a full drawn-out page. Like, it was just a one sheet, like an actual comic board, of just this massive pile of rubble. And on top is Lemmy sitting there. And he inked it and everything, and he goes, now you got to color it. And I was like, oh, you bastard. So I've got that bad boy hung up and framed. It's hilarious. It's not colored, I'll tell you that much.
Maybe a retirement project.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Give me about another 15 years, and it might get colored then.
There's a tremendous amount of rubble in that. I read the first volume just yesterday, reread it, and it's a running plot point that a destroyed building is like key to the plot of the whole first book.
It can be. I mean, they build a golem out of rubble. So I mean, even one of the characters is made out of rubble, and of course, you know, he's going to get blown up. So now it's like, oh, great. You know, more rubble to color. So the rubble has rubble. You know, that it's crazy. It's crazy. But it really is a ton of fun. What it ended up happening, when I started coloring, I didn't have like a Wacom tablet or anything like that. So it was just old school mouse. And if you look at some of those pictures, you can kind of go, wow, you know, coloring that with the mouse, not a whole lot of fun. So as time went on and it's like, oh, man, I've been able to do more and more work in comics. I was able to upgrade my equipment and finally I could like use a pen and a tablet. And it was like, oh, man. So then I told him when I got it, I see rubble ain't no bad now because I can go dot, 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 dot. Done.
What are the tools of the trade for color?
Typically, of course, you know, I work all digitally. Some people can do like, you know, watercolors and Copic markers and things like that. And that's way outside my scale. I mean, I haven't touched watercolors since I think junior high. So that's way outside my scale. I use a combination of Photoshop and Manga Studio or Manga, depending on who you talk to. And then I actually have a what's called a Unova tablet. And it's basically the far more affordable version of a Wacom tablet, to put it nicely. But that's the tools that I'm going to use. As far as like actually coloring, outside that, references, you know, constant references. You want to try and be true to what you're coloring. So a lot of times I'll take pictures of things, just different scenarios. You know, being in Texas, we get all the seasons sometimes in the same month. So it's real easy to gather reference for, you know, different types of lighting and mood and all that jazz. A whole lot of caffeine.
Now, do you find yourself, when you're reading comics just for fun, going, man, that's a guy I'd love to color? Or is it... If you like an artist, would you not want to color them? Or because I know in my profession, if I like something, the job gets harder because I spend my time looking at it.
I think for me, in that aspect, yeah, there's a little bit more time that I'll probably look into. Oh man, you know, I've been very lucky to have people send me pages to just, you know, practice on, obviously, because I'm not like a well-known colorist or anything like that. So I've got some pretty decent art friends, Patrick Zercher, I guess he's currently doing Green Arrow. He'll send me some of his pages that I could just kind of, you know, doodle on. And when I first really started getting into thinking about doing comics like seriously, like coloring them seriously, then he would send me stuff, and that was a little bit intimidating, I'm not gonna lie, you know. So not to discredit anybody else, but once you start getting people like that, you know, sending you their artwork, it's like, man,
his stuff would be challenging too. Yeah, he's a heavy anchor. Like, yeah,
am I gonna show this? Yeah. Which, and that's, you know, that's the other thing. Depending on the artist, sometimes they do a lot of their own, like, shading. And that's, sometimes they'll do that with their gray tones. So, like, when you color certain artists, you may not have to do a whole lot of shadow work to it, because the artist will do a lot of it for you. Whereas, you know, different people will have like just your basic outlines of characters and backgrounds with absolutely no black ink other than that. And that's where, you know, it gets a little bit more on the color side of things. It's like, okay, I made some decisions here. If you're lucky enough, then you get a lot of people who, yeah, you know, maybe the first couple of scripts, they kind of lay out, you know, what they want, what they're looking for color wise, right. You know, they may say, you know, for storyboards, you have to know, okay, maybe they want a certain color for this character, this theme, excuse me. And, So you got to work with that. And as time goes on, what I found was eventually as you kind of grow into the book, you kind of know, okay, here's where we need to be. Here's what you're looking for. And then they kind of go, well, why don't you just kind of, you know, do what you want to do? And I'm like, okay, that works out. That tends to be, at least my experience, that's how it's worked out. I think it's a little bit easier with creator-owned stuff just because, you know, you don't have any guidelines per se. You know, Superman always going to wear a red cape. Not always, but, you know, if you work on big characters, they typically have a specific color scheme that they're going to want you to use. And it's passed around. You know, they're all codes. So, but I've enjoyed the creator-owned stuff just because really a lot more fun to get to play around. So.
Well, and we've seen a big change in kind of the profile of colorists over the past few years. And, you know, I don't know whether that's people are seeing coloring a different way now, or if, I've seen some before and after stuff, some process stuff that I can't believe how much of the finished art is really all being done by the colorist.
Right. Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know what? It's funny that you mentioned that because I want to say what this was by a couple of years ago, I think, where Jordi Belair, I hope I'm saying that right. You know, she colors every book. I know that her profile got really big because she was really vocal about that, about, you know, colorists getting more credit. And more people kind of just started to kind of jump on that bandwagon. And I'm all for equal credit. I think that's important. I think everybody carries equal weight on the team. You know, you can't have one without the other. It's clear as day. But there is a huge amount of difference with depending on the artist, how much role the colorist will play. And of course, a lot of the times, the final version of an image is left up to the colorist. You know, even the colorist sometimes is the artist, and they catch something and they have to fix it because, man, you've got to hit this deadline. So I know there's been some stuff where I've worked on it and I read the script and I go, wait a second, this isn't supposed to be like this. It's supposed to be like this. And so I'd be like, you want me to fix it? And they'd be like, yeah, go ahead. So I've done that a couple of times. And I've heard that from other people. I think colorists are just as important as the artist. But of course, I'm in the same boat. I guess being on both sides of the track now, so to speak, is it's interesting because, you know, I understand like a letterer, you know, how important that is because I've seen books with bad lettering and man, that completely like takes me out of the story.
Oh, you know, that's one of the most deadly things for me is once a book has bad lettering, I'm out. No matter how gorgeous the art is. And, I mean, I've run into this at conventions and stuff, and a guy's trying to sell me his book, and I open it up, and the art is absolutely gorgeous. And usually I'm going for my wallet when I actually get around to actually, wait a minute, this is going to give me a headache.
Right.
If I actually tried to read this, and, you know, I can flip through it for 5 minutes and enjoy the art that way, but that's not the same experience as reading a comic book.
No, not at all. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I think letterists are, you know, they don't get talked about at all these days. Very rarely do you hear that, but it's kind of like, I guess if you want to look at the overall big scheme of things, it's like if it all works, then there's nobody's going to complain. But the second it doesn't work is the second you'll get picked out for it.
Well, it's like
that makes sense.
Yeah, there was a video that a friend of mine sent me this week that was you're not tired of CG was the idea of it. And it was a look at all the computer graphics and films that no one ever noticed because you only really notice the bad stuff. Right. I mean, I find letterings like that you notice when it's bad, and you might not even be aware of why it's not working for you. You might not be on a page and like the balloon placement on this page is all wrong. But there's something clunky about the book, and you can't put your finger on it. Like I was reading one of the top books from one of the big two today, and I stopped reading it on a page because I'm like, I just read all of those word balloons in the wrong order, and the conversation doesn't make any sense. So, you know, this thing that, you know, should really be, when it's done well, it's invisible, basically. But suddenly I was aware of it, and it's something that drives me nuts, and it sounds a bit pretentious when I try to explain it, but I don't want to be aware of the mechanics.
Right.
I don't want to be stopped and like, okay, so physically what's happening, like which balloon am I supposed to be on? I want to forget that I'm reading word balloons.
Right. And yeah, I can, you know, it's funny that you say that. Same thing happened to me last week. I was reading one of the big two books, and I'm an all digital reader. Sometimes I use the Comixology guided view, but a lot of times I stay out of it.
Right.
But if I'm in that guided view, depending on how the flow of that goes, the word balloon placement can get crazy on some books. And it's like, what am I reading? I mean, so I have to back out. But sometimes it's just like, you know, just looking at a page like you're supposed to, same thing. It's like, you know, okay. I think a lot of people misunderstand, you know, bad lettering doesn't always necessarily mean font, you know, doesn't necessarily mean they're using Comic Sans for everything. It's like you said, it's placement, you know, it's like, as soon as you take me out, I'm out. I mean, I got to get back into it somehow. And sometimes it's not that easy. God, but that drives me up the wall. So I understand that.
I saw a fantastic exchange on Twitter the other day. Patrick Zurcher had put up a panel from an X-Men comic and used it as an example of bad lettering, bad balloon placement, because he said, you know, what order are you supposed to be reading these in? Stop doing this. And Joe Caramanga got back to him right away and said, I lettered that page in the order the artist told me to.
And, you know, sometimes that's the way the cookie crumbles. Sometimes it's going to be, I'm just doing what I was told to do. You know? But again, I think that's kind of the joy of like creator own work. Cause I know sometimes I looked at something and I've gone, I don't think so. That's not going to work like that. Maybe we should try this. And if you're lucky enough, the people you work with will listen. If you're not, then it's like, hey, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean that's it, particularly on the creator one work where there's no editors involved. I mean, in a lot of ways, the creators become their own editors, and like, you know, becomes a peer group.
Right.
And and ultimately you all want the best product. Whereas, you know, sometimes when people are on a big two book, I mean, you're working through editors. You're not necessarily directly connected to anyone. They might be, you know, an issue. They're ahead an issue from where the letter and the colorist are.
Yeah. And you know, that in and of itself, that I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could just go through just an editor, you know, I think at that point, and a lot of people, this is something I see a lot of, they say making comics is a job. From different creators, it's like you have to treat it like a job, and I completely understand that. I do, but at the same time, I don't have to treat it like a job because I have a job. So, to me, it's fun. To me, it's what I enjoy doing. That's if I want a job, I do my job. So when I make comics, I want to have fun doing it, and I completely understand what those guys and girls are talking about. And that's, you know, I respect that. I do. but I don't have to treat it that way. I take it seriously. Don't get me wrong. I don't like missing deadlines. As a matter of fact, that's why right now I've been off of Amelia Cole for probably 7 months. And I've only done maybe a couple of pinups here and there. And that's just because I know that with what I'm doing now, work-wise, would take away from my ability to hit those deadlines. And I won't be one of those people that's going to be like, yeah, I can do it, I can do it. And then guess what? Deadline comes around and I've still got like 15 pages left to go. And to me, that's disrespectful to the people I would work with. And I'd rather just not put myself in that position or put that creative team in that position. So I'm a little bit more pickier, and I have that luxury because I do have another job. But again, that wouldn't be fun. Now editors can be cool. I've talked to a bunch of editors. I know a bunch of editors. But again, I just couldn't imagine, like, if you and I were making a comic book and weren't talking, you know, it doesn't make sense. I don't know. It's weird.
It is something that Capullo and Snyder went through it. When they started on Batman, they didn't actually like each other.
I talked to Scott about this. Scott actually helped me out a lot. Got me. Not that we're best friends or anything like that. But that's actually like the go-to. It's like, you know, you always see them talking about, you know, talking to each other, this and that. And then you hear stories about, you know, go through the editor.
Yeah.
So at what point in the big two do they go, okay, look, only you can talk to the editors, but guys, you guys are cool to talk to each other. Y'all do whatever, you know. Is there a pecking order? See, I don't get it. I don't understand. I guess depends on the popularity of the creators or the title
and the editor themselves. I mean,
who was it? Mike Martz was the Batman editor when Capullo came on, and Snyder was already on tech.
Yeah.
So, and then he left for Marvel, and of course Mark Doyle got promoted, or Mark Doyle took over for the Bat books. And, you know, he was the one that was with Snyder for American Vampire. You know, that's where,
yeah.
He's primarily a Vertigo editor. So, I mean, I think having a good editor that'll let you actually communicate, but, you know, man, I can't see it, like, not being able to. I mean, I'm sure it's not all like, oh, you can't talk to, you know, so-and-so.
Well, my understanding of the Capullo Snyder is the editor, when they first put them together, actually did discourage any contact. And then then there was a little bit of contact, and that went awry, which caused some problems. And then finally, when they actually were able to sit down, they worked it out. But
I think
it was that the editor, if you have an old school editor, they don't want their artist and their writer talking at all. But I think that might be just a generational thing, still hearkening back to the days when all comics were made in New York.
Yeah, I could that definitely. Yeah, I could see where that would be like the old back in my day. Yes, back in your day.
All right, what else do we want to talk about today? We got we could do a little news. I've got a couple of news items.
Ooh, what's on the news docket?
All right, well, the news is sponsored by Comicosity. Are you familiar with Comicosity, Reese?
I am quite familiar with Comicosity.
Now, when you go to Comicosity, is the first thing you click on the movie news?
Not the movie news, no.
That's because there is no movie.
I do everything.
There is no movie news on there. So don't go there for that. It is a comics only website. It purely comics, no TV stuff, no movie stuff. Turns out other people will cover that.
We should start lying about that. Movie news only.
Now you need the link bait. You should just randomly throw up there like some random movie news, like Freddy Krueger's coming back for the 14th time. That's and right. then they click on it, and it's like, fooled you, it's a comic, fool.
Oh, I didn't know we were going to have Mr. T on the show tonight.
That's right. It's all comic only stuff except for one link to Legends of Tomorrow spoilers. All right. So the big reveal. I think this has been spoiled in so many places, including by the writer of the book and DC Comics' own Twitter. The big return, New 52, well, sort of New 52-ish, we'll call it now, post-Flashpoint continuity reintroduction of Ralph and Sue Dibny was today, came out this week in Secret Six. Chris.
Damn, I did not know that.
Oh, sorry, Reese.
But before you go much further, ironically, I kept seeing all these tweets today about, Secret Six has big return. Secret Six has been so, and I've only had the first issue. So I actually bought all of them today. Again, I'm all digital, so it's real easy for me to go, oh, okay, well, I'll go ahead and load them all up. So
I feel terrible.
Damn.
Oh, what other spoilers do we have for the Secret Six? The 5 issues, we can spoil a lot, man. That's a fast moving book. Catman bisexual.
Catman actually a cat. I was hassling that coming. I was teasing our friend Matt today on because he said there were two big reveals in Secret Six this week. The other one, I'm not going to spoil what the other one is. There is another one.
No, hey, it's fine. Like I'm going to read them tomorrow at some point. I'm not acting. Spoilers don't bother me.
Yeah. there's something we disagree on then.
I need all the help I can get over here on Team Spoiler. I want to know stuff whether I've read it or not, because I forget it immediately.
So Matt didn't tell me what the second thing was, like second big reveal was in Secret Six. So I sent him I sent him a direct message of guesses, but then he must have been in a meeting or something. So I sent him like 10. He came back to like, it's none of those, but what on earth are you doing? So I was getting like, you know, the whole book is just post 0 hour. Identity Crisis was all a dream. Chris, react to Identity Crisis is not in the post Flashpoint continuity.
Well, it has to be.
Well, see, I would think that Identity Crisis resides in that same world of his that has like Gru and the Tick in the same universe.
No, I love Ralph Dibny. And Identity Crisis was a great story, and it probably was a nice end to a couple characters that didn't have a decent place to live in the DC universe. So, although I am kind of secretly happy they're back, I don't know how bright their future could possibly be. I have to say, keeping them out of continuity would be the way I'd go, but...
Wouldn't that be brutal? Bring them back in Secret Six and then have Identity Crisis happen again next year. Like, oh, it's the post-Flashpoint version, though. It's a whole thing.
But they're back in Secret Six, so, I mean, are they going to have a real good ending? I mean, in Secret Six? Track record doesn't look too good.
I gotta catch up on my Secret Six. I haven't read an issue since the issue one, and although I enjoyed it, and I'm a huge Secret Six fan from pre-New 52, I don't know why I haven't been keeping up on that, but, well, I love most of the characters, so.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they have like a big delay between issues? Because I remember getting the first one. I thought, man, they left this one seriously hanging. And then they literally left it hanging for like a while. And I was like, damn, is that second issue ever going to come out?
It was one of the ones that had it's had an odd publication because for reasons unexplained, they launched the book before Convergence, knowing that there would be a 2-month hiatus for it. So they only put out, I guess, what, 2 issues of it before the Convergence hiatus? So it was one of the odd ones. Like, yeah, that one and Sinestro were launched about the same time. So they only got 2 or 3 issues out and then went on break for 2 months. So
yeah.
It was it felt like the book was late when, you know, it was just launched at a really weird time.
That is so weird because I'm up to date on Sinestro, that's written by Colin Bunn, who I don't enjoy. And Gail Simone, Secret Six, who's writing I do enjoy, that's the one I seem to drop off because of a stupid delay. I don't know what's going on that one.
Well, that's the good thing about reading digital. They're always in stock.
Yeah.
Exactly. See, but that is also a problem because then you run into these people who say, oh, you should try this book. You should try that book. And next thing you know, you're buying all these damn back issues of Grayson, followed by the other issues of Midnighter.
What? he's subtweeting me and I'm right here. So...
I'm just bringing
You didn't like Midnighter as well.
No, I did. First issue was a little rough. I'm not going to lie. I had to go back and reread it because I'm willing to try something. It's not, you know, I'm not afraid to give it a go, you know. So I tried it and I was like, and then I went through and me and Keith were talking about Grayson and I was like, oh, let him try Grayson. I liked it. And he was like, all right, now go try Midnighter. And I'm like, and then I read it. I was like, oh, damn it.
No. I only read the issues of Midnighter because, well, basically I felt my life may be in danger if I didn't, because Matt Satori Griffin, of course, editor of Comicosity, our sponsor, loved the book so much. And I finished the issues and still kind of went, yeah, he's still Batman if he sucked.
Wow. Cool. Although I'm still trying to figure out what's going on with Apollo. I was looking for it. I know y'all have talked about this already.
Yeah.
Because I heard it. But I still haven't. I mean, and I just recently reread them. There is no direct mention in at least the United book.
Apollo broke up with him. But
Are you caught up on it, Reese?
Yeah, I'm up to number 3, right? 3?
Yeah, the breakup scene is in number 3. So
is it?
Yeah, maybe you just didn't connect because he's not in costume. I don't think they show him in costume. Oh. I think that may have thrown you off. Yeah, that he's. But yeah, you do see the breakup scene.
I do remember that, but I don't remember them actually, like, I don't remember the reason. I remember the breakup, but there wasn't really a reason. One of those, like, you're too good for me, sun god of Clark Kent.
I think I suspect they're tailing this out over the 6 issue probably. That's one thing I've really seen in the first couple of months here of DCU is that this stuff is really written for trade. They're doubling down on to the point where I've switched so much trade waiting on DC more so than I have in, like, since I started reading DC again at the New 52, because this stuff is so clearly written for trade and the book market is really huge for them right now.
You can tell just by their marketing schemes digitally. Just this week, they've switched most of their sales to trades only and not doing the issues on Comicsology.
Oh, really? Right.
So may be their marketing deal. I'm kind of hoping single issues will come back because I like those huge sales where all of a sudden they'll throw in, oh, we'll just throw in this extra little title that nobody remembers from the 80s, and I can collect a whole bunch of Suicide Squads.
There's some neat stuff. Last week with the Bombshells sale, there was some interesting stuff.
Well, they just added Superman issue 101 that has Conduit.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they are up to just about where I stopped reading Superman, actually. So that has been that's tempting on it because I quit. I quit maybe six months or a year after that.
Okay, let me ask you guys.
All right.
This is important.
All right.
Where do you stand on the...
You going to say Electric Superman?
No. Because then I'd have to go which one.
Obviously the red one.
So you're red.
We'll totally derailed you.
You're gonna get me over all that with the red and the blue. That's just gonna be a bad deal.
See,
I was.
Go ahead. All it reads is connection is gummed up.
I'm here.
Oh,
are you there?
Oh, thank God. I thought it was my connection.
Nope.
No.
All right.
Nope. Yeah, go ahead.
I hear you now.
All right. Here we go. We're not talking about Superman Red and Blue.
Okay, I'm prepared for the where do you stand on?
Superman's mullet.
That's what I was looking for.
The word I was going to say.
That's what I was looking for, the mullet. Is exactly where I was going with that. And I could not think of the word. I'm like, I could say long hair.
Oh, we're really Canadians. We have mullet on the brain all the time.
Or as
you know,
my preferred vernacular for it, the schlong, which means short on the front, long in the back.
Long on the back. That is great. Well, you know, to me, it always felt like he hid better with the mullet. Because, you know, Clark Kent could wear it back, slick it back, put it in the ponytail, and he can go by with his jive cell. Superman just let it all flow, Nick Cage style.
I have a nuanced view of the mullet. I have a nuanced opinion. I like the mullet on Superman. It was a very 90s look, but I liked the look of Superman with the longer hair. It was a bit more relaxed Superman. I really, really didn't like Clark Kent with a ponytail. It looked unprofessional.
I have to agree with you, Keith, although I just because the mullet came with that black costume, which I absolutely hated.
Oh, I love the black costume.
It just wasn't Superman. There's another downside, so I have to say I'm probably negative. But on a whole, if you just showed me a picture, I don't think it was a bad look.
Nah.
On the Superman. Artist, for sure.
It holds up. I'm sure.
I mean, certainly there was some artists, because there were four different artists on the book at that time. So, I mean, some of them, it was like, I mean, Bogdanov, it was like long flowing locks. Like, it was like full on Thor type hair. And, you know, Jurgens and Ordway only did a couple of, actually, I'm not even sure Ordway did any with the long hair now to think about it. Cause I think it was, he had left before Return of Superman. So who else was
right,
it? Tom Grummet. Tom Grummet was a bit more subdued and Jurgens was more subdued, but. Yeah, Bogdanov is like a second cape. Like, it was... He had a lot of hair going. It's cool to see...
Sometimes it was really blue.
Yeah, it was like some crazy colorist put blue highlights in his hair all the time.
Yeah, which, you know, they used to say his hair's blue. Really? You're going to give Superman blue hair.
It's strange. Everyone talks about the underwear on the outside thing, but no one ever talks about blue hair.
Exactly. See, you're going to notice the underwear, but you're not going to notice the blue hair. All right. So the fact that you got a walking smart isn't going to bother you at all.
I see no resemblance between Clark Kent and Superman. I mean, there's the blue hair.
See? So does that mean Pa had the blue hair? No. I mean, Jor-El clearly was a redhead.
That was the big talk around Smallville. What's going on there? Ma Kent doesn't have blue hair. Pa Kent doesn't have blue hair.
No, that can't be their kid. He's got to be adopted.
Continuity check for the younger listeners. For about 15 years, the origin was that everyone did think that they were his real parents. That he was not publicly adopted for those 15 years. He was their natural born child. That's the forgotten 80s Superman continuity.
I mean, seriously, though, go back and look at the blue hair. It's there. It's there.
I need to check it.
It's even there. You could see a lot of it during, like, go through the death of Superman. And you could see a lot of it there, especially when, and I thought this was brilliant, the death of Superman was, as they're building up to that final issue, when if you notice, they cut down the panels. And then you get to the last one, Superman 75, and it's one panel a page. So it's this subtle, like, height of the death of Superman. You can see the blue hair throughout that. That pulled me out of it more than anything. I'm like, oh, this is awesome, but he's got blue hair. What the?
No, but, I mean, you go back to older comics, there were a lot of blue-haired characters, including Batman, I might say. And I actually, when I'm reading older comics, I kind of miss it because the blue shows more hair detail. You can see what the artist is doing. And as long as you have a lot of blue hair characters, you don't really notice. But you're a colorist, so you'd notice right away, and I can understand that. But using modern colors and stuff, I find we lose some detail.
Well, and you know, you bring up an interesting point with that. I think there is such a thing as over rendering, and a lot of that is left up to the colorists. So I think that when you get into certain works where you use, like, you know, it's like certain colorists want to be like the JJ, you know, you want the, you know, the glare, the lens flare and everything, you know, I mean, I think that could be problematic. With coloring, and I know that there would be times when, as I kept evolving the style that I use, it was like, man, you know, am I rendering enough? So it's a real hard line because you look at certain colorists' work, and it's like, for instance, FC, example from Batman, and honestly, I prefer his work from like Invincible. That's where I really noticed his work. I mean, it is right there on that final render. But then you get, that's kind of another good example. I'm not gonna pronounce his name, but I think it's Marte Garcia. He's done a lot of like the X-Men books. He's one that can pull off rendering where it can be too much, but it still looks good. It's really weird to describe, but I'm sure if you actually like would look at it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
All right. We lost you a bit there, but I think we got the gist of it.
Blah blah blah, color, blah 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 blah. Buy comics, kids.
Keith, when are we going to put in those fiber optic cables we keep talking about?
We do. We need to mail them to.
It's got to be the Texas heat.
I did want to mention that there was one more news thing I wanted to mention that it was I discovered it on Twitter today. I'd actually heard some behind the scenes stuff, but when we're talking about creator owned and indie, it's so incredibly important to support the books that you like, all of them, but especially outside the big two. Curtis Weeb, a friend of the show, answered a question on his Twitter a couple weeks ago about where the final two issues of Peter Panzerfaust are. And he was quite frank with the person, said, you know, what's happening with these? It's been months and months. And Curtis responded that they haven't made money on the book in over a year. And they are focused on paying work. Tough news to take that basically, like, these two issues are going to be done at some point, there's just no money in finishing the series, which is really, really saddening for a book that was, like, so incredibly good.
Oh, that's sad. I don't... Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, that's always one of those... it's hard. Because, you know, another thing is nobody wants to work for free. You know, you hear a lot about this where people will talk, you know, oh, you can get exposure, you know, don't work for free. Or, you know, I always find it when it comes to creator owned, depending on the book, at least in my opinion, not that I necessarily work for free, but I'm more than happy to discount my fee if it means the book can keep going. Sometimes that's what it takes, and that's always sad to hear. You never want to hear that, but unfortunately, that's just, you know, that's that aspect of comics that is a business. You know, I mean, you talk about, you know, with the big two trade waiting because they're clearly designed for that, and sometimes that's what kills a book. You know, you trade waiting for creator on a book. So, it's a tough market.
And I mean, the big two can do that because they can afford to front money. I mean, creator owned, you're already fronting money to do your first couple issues because you're not seeing money for, you know, 6 months, a year, like who knows how long from the time you put pen to paper to when that money from Comixology and Diamond actually comes back to you.
Right.
And then, I mean, basically you're just moving that money forward to keep you going. But, I mean, the big two can afford to have a book sit for 6 months doing so-so because they know the trade's going to be worth money for the next 10 years.
I wonder if any of this explains the delays on Rat Queens, because they're only on issue 11. And I mean, I'm guilty because I've been trade waiting this one.
I think Rat Queens is just photocopying dollars. Like I don't think that one's anything to do with sales. I suspect he makes the mad money on that book.
Well, I that's what I always heard. But once again, I looked at my new books today, and we're only up to 11, and it seems to be it's been going on forever now. So,
well, they had to change artists after a few issues too, so that definitely put a ringer in things. A lot of creator owned now are switching to like 8 issues or 10 issues a year because of you know, Reese, you were talking about the complexity of art now, and
right,
and that's certainly, I mean, certainly something Patrick Zurcher talks about on Twitter all the time is how much longer art takes because the expectations are so much more detailed than used to be, but that means that, you know, an artist is not really at the 2 to 3 weeks on a book that they were 20 years ago. A lot of them are on 5 weeks a book, and 5 weeks an issue doesn't work out to 12 issues a year.
Well, and yeah, and you got to think about the health too, because I mean, you can only do so much work, and you know, I know we've been using his name a lot, but Capullo today was talking about that. You know, his doctor was recommending him cutting back his workload.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, your body and your mind can only take so much before it. You know, it's one thing to hit your deadline; it's a whole other thing to, you know, put yourself in a health scare, and there is a bigger demand. You're right. There is a lot of more expectation. But I also think we're in a time now where we're a little bit more understanding of that. At least, I don't know, that's the impression I feel.
Yeah, and you know, that's the one regret I have from our Dan Juergens episode when we talked to him. I didn't think of it at the time, but all the artists we always talk to, socially and like that, are always complaining about aches and pains, and they're worried about carpal tunnel and different things. And how do you keep yourself healthy? I mean, Dan Juergens has a body of work which would dwarf most.
It's unbelievable the amount of.
It's unbelievable how much he's. I've seen him walk around, and he's like, you know, he's upright and stuff, and arms seem to work, and he's still working.
I looked him up on ComicVine, which is a great database for comics. Characters and creators. I look up creators all the time on there to look back through where they've been in various places. And he had something crazy, like 1,600 or 1,700 comics listed on there.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's one of my favorites. I love his work. It doesn't matter if he's writing it or drawing it. I love it.
Just an astounding body of work. And that's what's got me thinking about getting back into Superman almost 20 years delayed. there are these Juergens issues that there's actually about probably 4 years of Juergens that I've never read of Superman. Because he continued working on writing and drawing that book until like about 150.
Right.
And I dropped off. Trial of Superman is where they're at now on Comixology, which is like 100 and 101 of Superman.
Right.
And I think maybe it's a year later was where I finally quit, and it was the big space storyline that they did. So I was out before they did Electric Superman and all that.
I guess, yeah.
So, yeah, because they did that big, and it was just an incredibly long story. And that's why I dropped off. I just lost interest in the 6 months.
Wait, wasn't that where Supergirl was found? The Matrix Supergirl was found?
No. Oh. No, way earlier than that. Matrix Supergirl.
Way earlier than
that? That was the end of Burns' run. That was before Juergens even started.
Yeah. And I think that what you're talking about was his second space.
Yeah.
Because there was that one. There was the one where he exiled himself.
Yeah. Exile.
Yeah.
But the last, it was a Trial of Superman.
Yeah, okay.
And it was it was an incredibly long, I mean, at that point they were in triangle numbers, so it was all one big story. Yeah. But,
well, and you know, what's crazy about that, if you know, thinking back to that, it's like, man, you know, those carried over into the other books too. So it was like you had like an issue a week.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, of course, the same writer and artist, but man, just
I love that.
You talk about pumping things out. Jeez.
At that point, they had 4 monthly books, and then they added a quarterly, and they did that with Batman as well, so that they would feed the beast that there was a Superman book every single week. 'Cause 48 issues of the main books, and then a quarterly giving you 4 issues a year. After Death of Superman, after Return of Superman, they added that quarterly, and then they had done Nightfall, which was a giant boost to Batman. But that meant there was a Batman and a Superman every single week, and in Superman, it was a one basically continuing story. It was like a soap opera. It was like, I absolutely love that that pace. I'm missing it right now, actually, because I was a huge fan of Future's End.
Well, and that's, Future's End was good, and they got, what, that Batman Eternal.
Yeah.
Right? So I kind of feel like Superman gets the shaft on this, but they kind of did it with the whole, like, I guess, the out-of-order truth story they're doing now. I guess it's kind of like how it used to be, you know?
It's thematically tied right now, but it's not one storyline, but it's thematically tied, but
yeah.
I can't quite
probably more accurate would be like Doom. Doomed would probably be more accurate.
Doomed was the big like one comic to the next storyline.
I just read that one last week.
Yeah.
Cause they you're right, Chris, you were talking about the, them focusing on like trade sales on digital, and they had like a bunch of them on sale, and Doomed was like $4.99. I was like, well,
here we go.
So I was like, I was all over that. $4.99, sure. Why not?
What'd you think of it reading it all together?
I think I'm glad I read it all together, because if I'd have read it apart, I would have been like, what is going on? I mean, it seemed to work. It actually kind of fell off for me at the end, though. It was weird, because it seemed like it had all this really, and not to make fun of what I've been hearing about the Fantastic Four movie lately, but it's like, you know, act one and two, great. Three, nope.
Well, and the weird part about Doomed is it's actually to be continued into Convergence.
See, that confused me, because, you know, reading Convergence and seeing that whole deal that where we get the first shot, the first big one-page deal with the crystals looking back in all the other worlds, and I'm like, huh? But comics, right?
Yeah. it'll all be way smoother at, like, you know, 2 years from now. You read Doom, you get to the end, you're like, oh, yeah, this goes into Convergence. I'll just read Convergence now. And you forget that there was, like, 6 months between those two things, and they had nothing to do with each other. And
I think that when y'all covered Convergence, when y'all had the original discussion about that, I think I laughed almost the entire episode. That was one of my favorites. I heard that a lot, too, from Chris.
No, Convergence is something I can pick and choose, but on a whole, it didn't do it for me. At least with Doom, they didn't change anything. We could have had an Age of Ultron situation where they just sort of went, okay, that's Doc Ock, Spider-Man, and yeah, that'll work. when stuff comes out late.
I mean, y'all have read Doomed, right? So
yeah, I
read an issue.
I read the first couple issues and didn't and couldn't get into it. So that was actually when I quit the Superman Tales, but I came back and read the last one. The annual that wrapped it up, because of my love of Superman in the 90s, I desperately want to get back into Superman. It just keeps not working for me. I am liking the two Greg Pak ones right now.
See, Superman is my go-to. That's what I grew up on. That's always been my character for me, Superman. I mean, it's the only tattoo I've got. And, you know, I think the more that I get into this whole truth deal, like if we ignore the big, his secret was exposed, you know, because, I mean, I think that's interesting. Don't get me wrong, because that's new. But I think what I'm liking is how they're, and I can't remember where I read this. It was in an interview, probably on Comicosity. But someone had put it, like, now that he's basically losing his powers or hit, cut down his powers, is you're seeing a more humanized Superman in the sense that, all right, he's getting angry or upset, or he's starting to relate more on a more grounded level. And after I read that interview, going back and reading what they put out so far, it actually makes sense. It's like, oh, wow, okay, I can actually see that now. So you're starting to see a more, you know, flawed Superman now, which is interesting because it hasn't always been that way. And that was and this is what gets me. I'll argue this all day long. This is what gets me about this. People get pissed off because they're like, he's too powerful. He's too strong. nobody can fight him unless you've got, you know, yada yada yada. But then, you know, all right, let's humanize him, let's depower him a little bit. And then people are gonna, man, now he can't do that. God, make up your damn mind. Which one do you want? Here's your cake, eat it. You know. Sorry, that's just a little personal.
No, I totally agree with you. I've had exactly that same complaint that everyone says that, yeah, he's too powered. There's no one to fight. And there's no one to fight him. Like, you can't put him up against anyone. So they make a little movie where they put him up against someone who's equal powered, and they're like, that's awful. They're like, look at the size of the fight they had. Like, I don't know what the hell you want then. let's go back to Lex Luthor trying to make an earthquake machine. Fine. Whiny bastards.
Yeah. Come on. Really? Come on. What do you want? I mean, jeez.
I can't please anybody. My theory is what people really want from Superman is for him to be exactly the way he was when they were a kid, but they do not want to read that book.
No, exactly.
They want it to exist.
Because it's like pudding, man.
They want that.
But they don't want to know it.
They want it to exist, but they don't want to have anything to do with it.
Nope. It's like popping in one of them movies from your childhood that you think, maybe this will hold up. And then it's like, I should have never put that in.
If you're a tall, scared, Last Starfighter is not one of those movies. You should rewatch that one.
It continues to be awesome. I watched it not too long ago.
Hey, Monster Squad. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
My wife's favorite film.
It still holds up.
Wolfman's got Nance.
That's right. Wolfman's got Nards.
Kick him in the Nards. I watched Beverly Hills Cop on Netflix a couple weeks ago, and then 2 and 3 were not on Netflix, so I had to request them from the library. So that in and of itself was an interesting moment of, please special order me Beverly Hills Cop 2 and 3 on DVD.
You probably got flagged for terrorists.
Probably. I'm on a watch list now. So Sunday I watched Beverly Hills Cop 2. I'm like, oh, it was okay. It's you know, no great shakes, not as good as the first one, but you know, enough that I didn't remember it was worth watching. And then I watched 3, which was I honestly wondered if I had had a stroke partway through, if there was part of the film missing.
Well, it's like the Rocky movies. You know, I can watch all the Rocky movies, except one of them will never exist to me, and that's the 5th one. You can just completely get rid of that one.
No, Rocky 5 is okay. It's not Shakespeare, but...
What's weird to me is I did watch all of those, because I got the big box set that has all of them. And what's weird to me is that 5 and 6 are essentially the same movie. They're like alternate endings to the series. It's like you watch 1 to 4, and then you could watch 5 or 6, but really both of them together doesn't make any sense.
Right. It's like, oh my God, Peter Petrelli's Rocky's son.
But I mean, you could watch 1 to 4, and then either one of those, and it's like, okay, well, here's the end of the story when Rocky's an old guy.
Yeah.
And I think we're about to get like a third version. It's like it'll be like a choose your own adventure ending.
Because
we're about to be Creed,
yeah.
Which is going to be more of a thematic sequel to like 4 than it is anything else.
I am actually excited. I love the Rocky movie, so I'm excited for Creed. I just hope Apollo comes back as a Black Lantern.
I like that.
Which one does Apollo die in? Is it 3 or 4?
3.
It's 4. No,
No, you're right. He dies. The Russian kills him.
Russian kills him. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
naked Punisher kills.
I do suspect that we're going to be out that it, like this Creed movie is going to really function like a fifth Rocky film again. That you're going to you could skip 5 and 6.
Yeah, well, watch. You know what's going to happen. Creed's son is going to get beat up so bad that Rocky's going to have to step in the ring and take care of business.
Oh, my God. That'd be awesome.
He's going to be like, yo, Creed, I got this one for you. I'll take care of it, okay?
That is a series I can't get enough of.
It's like the ultimate pick-me-up. I just watched this movie called The Warrior with my wife a couple days ago, which has Tom Hardy in it. And it's like an MMA one. And I was like, oh, here's my Rocky fix. But I'll tell you what, and Keith, you know this, Tom Hardy's been taking over my household here lately. My wife keeps buying these Tom Hardy movies. I'm starting to get a little worried.
I know that one. The different actors will come through. And there was a time that any time I had to work late, I would come home and 300 would still be sitting in the Blu-ray player. that was about a year worth of.
Let me ask you this, though. Were you more upset that 300 was sitting in the Blu-ray player, or were you more upset there was a Blu-ray in your Blu-ray player?
Usually I'm only upset if the surround sound's been left on. That bugs me, but.
You know, you should have taken the disc out and hit it and just put the comic book right on top of the player.
Oh, man. I started looking up Rocky and I remember no idea what we were
going to watch. This is a great episode of just randomness. We went from blue hair to mullet to Rocky to Creed. We don't discriminate on this episode at all.
Absolutely not. Has there never been a Rocky comic book?
No. And, you know, I don't know if anybody is suited to write. Okay. Y'all did the creator deal not too long ago, the universe deal. Who would you do to have a Rocky? Who would you pick to have a Rocky comic book? Oh, what would be your team?
Brutal. Nostalgia wants me to say Neil Adams because he did the Muhammad Ali.
Oh, the Superman Muhammad Ali.
But under no circumstances should he be allowed to write. And that's a general rule. That's not just for this. talk about a lettering challenge.
Exactly.
You seen Odyssey? Man.
Oh, man.
It's more like spot art around a novella than it is a comic book. Topical. I'll be hassling that book for years. So you got Neil Adams, and who writes the Rocky book? Ed Brisson. Ed Brisson and Neil Adams, Rocky.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to agree with you as far as Ed Brisson because he's the only guy out there that I think is really kicking it with the properties. But you know what? I'm gonna go a completely different direction for the artist, Riley Rossmo.
Wow,
that's awesome!
Wow,
I can see what he'd do in the head, and I'd assign the colorist I hate most because I mean that guy's just gonna commit suicide after because I cannot imagine what Riley would do with Rocky that could possibly be colored.
You know what? I think I'm going to go, and I don't know if I'm going to say his last name right. Ryan Ferrier? Is it Ferrier?
Ferrier.
Ryan Ferrier for Rocky. Huh. And you know what? Might as well take Ramon for artist, because I actually think that would be a good combination.
that would be.
I think that would be interesting.
Hey, I'm getting a ROM comic book next year, so you know what? Anything's possible. We could indeed see a Rocky comic book in support of the Creed movie.
You never know.
Maybe we should start tweeting IDW right now.
All right, so But who does the inevitable Ivan Drago miniseries then from IDW? They get the Rocky property.
Oh man, I would want to color it. I know that.
It's just, oh wow! It's just 60-year-old Ivan Drago, post-Soviet Russia.
I would break you.
Doesn't leave his armchair for the entire series. Just sits and drinks.
Oh, who did Whiteout? Get the guy who drew Whiteout.
Give it
Steve Lieber? Lieber?
Oh yeah, perfect.
Oh, you know what? No, you're talking about beat up. Looks good, beat up. David Aja.
Oh.
Get David Aja to do it.
I don't think you don't need a colorist. That book's black and white.
Exactly. See, yeah. I wouldn't even have to do anything. Sign
spot
my name
color.
On the check.
Oh wait, no, it's spot color.
It's good. The white and black is color. It's good.
Yeah, it's no. Do it Sin City style with like one color.
Yeah, there you go. Like one red drop.
Yeah,
just for the blood. Just blood effect.
Because it's just the five issues of Ivan Drago fighting polar bears. That's I've decided that I am the writer. I'm going to pitch for that book. I want to do the Ivan Drago 60-year-old washed up.
No. Soviet. You know what? The Soviet Union shorts have to be colored.
Oh, true.
With both the red and the little yellow hammer and sickle in the corner.
Nice.
I mean, could you imagine the little girl crying after Ivan Drago beats up a polar bear? And the polar bear's laying there, and Ivan Drago looks down to her and goes, "If he dies, it dies."
Wait, wasn't that a scene in The Expendables 3?
It would have saved that movie.
It would have.
All right. Well, we're not gonna. It's not gonna get better than that. let's call it a show on that. And Reese, thanks so much for coming on, and we will have you back. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you guys so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Yes, it has.
And Reese asked me what it was like being a guest on the show, and our guests from last episode said it was like dropping by the comic shop and talking comics. So I hope it has been that experience for you, Reese.
Oh yeah, that and oh so much more.
Okay, I'm Reese. When your Joe job cleans up, are you going to be able to return to Amelia?
You know, that's always open. That's always on the table for me to go back. Those guys are like brothers. I owe a lot to Adam and DJ and Nick. If I think I can hit deadlines, then I would go back in a heartbeat. I don't know if I'll make it back before they wrap the series up, but I'd like to hope that I could get back to it because I love that book. It's hilarious. But I hate the rubble.
when they do the next Amelia Cole in space, then you're all over it.
No, yeah, in space, yeah. See, but then they'd just be blowing up planets. That's I know those guys. That Adam would write it in the script. Oh, we launch a nuke at the planet and it blows it up in space rubble. God, that's great.
Amelia Cole in the vacuum of doom.
Reach just hands everything back and says, "You know what this book needs? Black and white."
That's right. With a drop of red.
Just one drop. Yeah, just do one color and hand it back.
One
bet. Sin City was brilliant here.
Put that in your Frank Miller and smoke it.
All right, Reese, thanks for coming by. Chris, say your last stuff.
Follow me at Chris_WeTalk. And I would just like to say I was saddened by the news of Yvonne Craig. She had some special moments in my youth. Goodbye, Batgirl.
Definitely.
It was a sad day, for sure. All right, and you can follow us on Twitter. We Talk Podcasts. Like us on Facebook. We Talk Podcasts there as well. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can hear this show on WeTalkPodcast.com and on Comicosity.com. And for all of your Legends of Tomorrow spoiler news. And Stitcher as well. And I'm sure there's a whole bunch of other places. You can send us an email at comics@WeTalkPodcast.com. And thanks again, Reese. And we are OUT.